unusual, different. So those are some of the things that I would say. But I mean, for me, it would be, you know, this changes in leadership that is not there.
Chairperson, no further question.
Thank you very much, Honorable Tsedi. Honorable Mare.
Thank you, Chairperson. Good day, Mr. Dom. I want to start off just going back to one thing. As in the office, when you meet with the minister, together with the chairperson, he makes the remark that you're arrogant. But between the CEO of such a big company and the chairman of the board, there should be a good working relationship. And it's very odd, it's quite odd, to appoint two people in the chairman's office. And when you actually sometimes come back to your office, as you described, you receive an envelope on your desk with a letter in. Surely there should be an engagement between the chairman of the board and the CEO of such a big company. Did you experience or feel that these two people that's been appointed in the office of the chairman in some way have to run this big company, Eskom, pass you as the CEO?
Yeah, I mean, that's certainly good. So you're correct, in terms of envelopes and such an important issue around succession, I would expect just decency and a discussion would be what you would expect as a norm. I would, you know, the two individuals did start interacting with parts of the company, and that's part of the communication that I'm talking about. You know, that, you know, you have communication that flows not through the chief exec or the executives, or for that matter, the finance director, but directly to the board. That's greater concern.
How would you describe your relationship with the Minister of Public Enterprises?
As we engage, we never had bad engagements. I was always clear about the issues that I needed to raise and deal with. But I mean, we never had a bad engagement. I'm not somebody that is to be described as arrogant. Maybe it's correct, and I've got a particular weakness in that regard. But I never had a particularly bad relationship.
Did you experience or have any interference of any other minister of the cabinet while you were CEO?
Not that I can recall. I mean, we engaged with the Minister of Energy because it's a policy ministry. Like I said, I used to send the power system status at least, not twice a day, but once a day to all of those individuals. But ministers, you know, not. I mean, the Minister of Finance was very important in our life. Minister of Energy was very important. The environmental issues were very important. You know, we engaged with the Minister of Environmental Affairs around the environmental issues that Eskom faced, you know, the investment to meet the environmental requirements.
Now, the erection of the two power plants, Medupi and Kusile, that is, I would say, two of the biggest capital projects undertaken by Eskom in its history. In your view, have the projects been manipulated to benefit certain specific companies?
Like I said, the procurement of Medupi went through some review. There was an investigation done around particular issues. I think the public protector did that at some stage. The issues that were raised with us, we've investigated those as they arise and dealt with. You know, and those things are quite transparent as to how we've done the procurement of Medupi, Kusile, from that perspective. You know, other than that, within the projects, there were certain issues that were very grave concern to us, particularly at Medupi, around the welding issues, you know, that we found there was issues for how contractors conducted themselves. Those we've dealt with, we reported them. They were investigated.
A follow-up on that. the Hitachi contract, and it is directly related to what you just have said, in your view, that you've never been appointed to do that specific job?
The procurement of the power stations was done. The outcome of the procurement was a recommendation at the time that Alstom should do both the boilers and the turbines. And that is public knowledge. Like I said, this was very clear. We could not reach an agreement with Alstom around the boiler contract. We could on the turbines. And it meant that we had to reopen the tender process and re-evaluate both tenders. Out of the re-evaluation, the appointment of Hitachi came about. And again, that went through the proper governance within Eskom, which is the independent checks again, did all of that over again, and that led to the appointment of Hitachi.
Was there any interference from any person down the line while these two big capital projects are on the way? Because the overrun time on these two projects is enormous, and the capital and the budget related to it, I would say you can't actually imagine from where it started as the budget for these two projects and where we're ending up now.
You know, in terms of your specific question, you know, the issues, as I said, specifically to these projects were raised, were dealt with, and there may well be a lot more that needs to be dealt with, and one should do that. The Medupi budget, when we contracted Medupi fully, if that's the one I can recall, when all the contracts were put in place, the budget was 92 billion rand. By the time I left Eskom, I think it was 105 billion rand. So that was the difference. So the projects are big. There were many delays. The committee were there. There were labor issues that ran for more than a year. There were particular contract issues. It could have been done better. It should have been done better. It's not unique. Actually, not unique. It's, large projects have these issues. But the issues that you raise, if they are there, they were dealt with, and there are reports for that. And if it's not been dealt with, it should be dealt with.
My last question is around the maintenance of the various power stations. When you were CEO, did you actually have a strict hand on that, that must be maintained? Because at the end of the day, we were going to the 2010 soccer and all those. And it seems that the maintenance didn't actually fully been dealt with, because we wouldn't end up in such a situation, because the economy didn't grow, so the demand for more energy wasn't there. So that's the experience of some of them. Even said it, that in some cases of your studies, that some of these power stations could be closed. And when this demand were there, was the maintenance in place for all these existing power plants?
I can take you back to the 2008 load shedding. We spoke about the coal and the actions taken. The one other action that we did take was the review of all the power stations. It was done by an international company, the half of it. We had a huge maintenance program ahead of us. There were issues around the high-pressure pipework that needed to be addressed. Many of the things that for many years as a station manager we used to do were not done. And we needed to put all of that in place. And those programs was returned. I also said to you that we put in place specific governance around the maintenance, the technical part of ESCOS. So we created I think it was an engineering committee chaired by one of the EXCO members, so that, you know, the choices around the maintenance to be done and not to be done, and how you would deal with changes at Medupi or Kusile, that's technical nature, that you don't have just one person making a decision. There was an EXCO committee that did that, and the colleagues dealt with that properly. So we've done the maintenance. I think I would say that the effectiveness of the maintenance is an issue that I had a concern with, that, you know, the plant got maintained. You know, the plant got older. You know, an outage sometimes at Creel would take, you know, quite a long time, and then to do six of them. And so we certainly had a clear program around how we would do the maintenance. The planning normally gets done between generation and system operations. We had an ERCC, an emergency control governance structure to look at that, and we had a technical committee to then deal with the governance of ESCOM, of the technical part of ESCOM and the maintenance aspects of ESCOM. So certainly a lot of maintenance work was done, and I think over that period could have done more, but certainly the maintenance was done. I think the effectiveness of the maintenance was an issue. That's something that I personally had an issue with. But also maintenance is different aspects. The plants had to do their routine maintenance. You know, you can't just hold it. And those are some of the issues that we dealt with. So you're absolutely correct. We ran a constrained power system for quite a long time. It was difficult. It was very difficult. And it was very important that we make sure that the country had the power. What happened afterwards, I would not speculate as to what happened afterwards.
My last question is not directly related to you. You had a very good relationship with the CFO, and you worked well together, and he almost left the same time that you left. What was his reason for resigning or leaving the company, the CFO?
Well, I would have to recall. I think the issues that Paul dealt with was very, there was a lot of pressure on him as well. In terms of just the work, and it was never, you felt that you were never like good enough, it was always an issue. There was also quite a lot of issues raised around his, some things he did and all of that we investigated, and it was just not the environment that he wanted to continue on. We were both quite committed to finish, particularly Medupi, to get Eskom through that phase of it being funded. It runs, we get through the power system, we get to a point where there's enough power, the thing is done, funded, all of that. But the environment has just not allowed us to do that. And we can go look at these specific reasons in his letter.
Thank you very much, Honorable Mare. You just work on your time. I take it, Honorable Kwangwa, you don't have any questions because I did not see your hand up. So I'll just wrap the day.
No, Chair, because I caught the last part of the presentation. I was in the chief groups. That's why. Okay.
Thank you very much. Mr. Damas, I am worried about the fact that you are saying we started this process very late. To me, you are saying we have let down the country. We have let down the economy of South Africa to go down in front of our eyes. But there are people like you who were hands-on at Eskom, who were part of the executive of Eskom, who knew what was happening within the utility itself, and you never raised any alarm to this committee or to any authorities. Some of the things that have happened during your time that was asked by other members, you never raised them with anyone, and that alone raised suspicion. What do you think should have been done during that time and during the start of what you saw happening and up to now?
Chair, I mean, my comments is really just input for the committee. I'm not saying, placing blame on you as to what you should and should not have done. Things were certainly different at the time. We had, as I said in the beginning, quite difficult to articulate these things very clearly as what we know now, as you see it now versus then. I did raise alarm. I remember around the reasons of me leaving and engaging with that. Actually engaging with the former chair of this committee and the chair of the Committee of Energy. They asked me, and I told that to them. And so I may not have articulated it correctly. So that's, as I say, at the time these things were not as clear or as the way we all see it now. But we have raised an alarm. You know, the engagement when I was asked by the minister as to what is the problem, and saying, you know, but the problem is the governance and this role of executive versus non-executive. is a problem.
You raised also 2010 as, if I heard you correctly, you said 2010 is when the things were changing, if I heard you correctly. But I just wanted to check, during 2010, the role of ESCOM, has it changed because of the huge amount of money that got into the country, that ESCOM might have been part of the entities that would have get or received some of those monies, or is there a reason that you think that has changed the way ESCOM operates, or the executive and the board within ESCOM are operating or were operating?
I think my reference to post the World Cup is really the reference to the appointment of the new board. So everybody were replaced in the new board. I can't recall exactly the date. So I was, for me, there was the World Cup, it was a big issue, and it was after the World Cup. So.
We are in this crisis now. I would say it's a crisis because we have experienced all these things. There's a lot of information out there that is a bad reflection on the entity or on our FOCs. When you look at what is happening now, somebody raised something that says it might not change. Do you think, do we have a chance within from now to the coming 10 years, would we be able to change the direction that ESCOM seems have to be taking to get it in the correct direction where it should be? And also, how is this going to affect the people on the ground, changing where ESCOM is now and where ESCOM should be in the near future?
I'm very optimistic. Yes, this can be changed, should be changed, and I'm confident that you'll be able to do that. And, you know, we have, it's a big organization, so very good people still there. And yes, you can change it. And yes, it's got a unique and a very important role in developing the country, in transforming the country. And you can do that by running a very good operation that is commercially sound as well.
Thank you, Mr. Damas. And I'm not going to have further questions on it because some of my questions have been raised by members. But I'm not, because of time, I just want to thank you very much for availing yourself for the inquiry, and I'm glad that you are saying you are safe, you did not get any threats for coming to this inquiry. And you let us engage as much as we wanted with you. But I want also to say to you, if there are any threats, do not wait until it raises alarms that it is really a threat. Immediately there is a threat, go to the relevant authorities and report any threat that comes your way. Members, we still have one witness that we need to take. I am not sure if we should go on lunch break or we should continue and just have our lunch, because we did prepare a lunch for members, and then we'll take it after we finish with the next witness. Anybody that can give us guidance or can suggest anything?
Shouldn't we have a 5-minute break whilst the new presenter sets up, and we should continue? I think we should continue because we've got to sit in at 2 o'clock. So we should try to, 3 o'clock, we should try to finish by the sitting. But we could, and we could have a working, I don't know what the lunch arrangements are, but for me it's more important to get the work done and to hear the witnesses, Jim.
We'll take a 5-minute break then. They presented to us, but now what they are going to present to us now, it's different to what they presented to us. It's not different in the fact that they have changed, they've changed what they have presented. Today they are unplugging the corruption at Eskom. They are going to focus on Eskom. If we remember well, members, when they presented to us, they took the state capture process, all of it, but today they are going to focus on Eskom alone. So we will give them time to present to us and we will engage to them. I don't think they will take much of our time. I will give them only 45 minutes to present and then we engage. If the information, if they are not done, they are going to continue, but I'm giving them 45 minutes. Welcome to the inquiry of Eskom. I just want to say to you, we welcome you. We have started the inquiry. People have been waiting for it. So we started it yesterday. We are continuing. We are going to take a break tomorrow and we will continue on Friday. Everybody else that is here should know that we will continue on Friday at 9:30. We'll take half of the day and then we'll come back next week. I will now give over to the organization to take us through their presentation. Thank you very much.
Madam Chair, members of the House, good afternoon. It's my privilege to present this information to you, and given that there's a time restriction, let me go right ahead. The reason for this presentation over and above the previous presentation is because we feel that some pertinent points need to be made. The objective of this presentation is to put the House in a position where they can see what needs to be done to get Eskom back onto a solid path, one way or the other, whether it's in pieces or as a whole. The difference between this presentation and a lot of speculation in the media and so on is I'm trying to, in this presentation, differentiate between the cause of the rot and the symptoms. Everybody's got a story about the symptoms. Very few people understand where the thing started. I also want to discriminate between fact and hearsay. For the record, I was the consulting unit manager at Eskom from 1988 onwards. until 1991. And in fact, that's the unit that McKinsey was prepared to charge Eskom $1.4 billion to reconstitute. And I think I can do it for less than 10% of that cost. As far as my own profile is concerned, I have qualifications in commerce and law and a little bit in mining. And when we ran the consulting unit, Eskom was one of the top utilities in the world. And I think we tried to do a good job, and the world seemed to have recognized that. I'll now take you to the next slide. For the record, I want to state that pre-2000, Eskom ran for about 100 years as an entity governed by statute and had never had to call on any government guarantees during that period of time. In 2001, the Eskom Conversion Act was passed, and Eskom then converted from an entity guaranteed by statute to a company under the Companies Act. At that time, Eskom also abandoned its electricity council, which constituted users who gave direction to Eskom for all the years since the 1987 Act, and replaced that with a normal board, company board. And I think that's where things changed dramatically. That's when Eskom changed its engine from a tractor engine to a Formula One Ferrari engine. And very few people seem to understand the differences between driving a tractor and driving a Formula One racing car. Also in 2000, we had the passing of the Preferential Procurement Act, or the BE Act as we call it. And that opens the door for BE preferential treatment. And as we go down the timeline, we'll see why that is of importance. It is important to note at this stage that with the conversion of Eskom from a company organized by statute to a company under the Companies Act, Eskom's executives seemingly were not well enough versed to understand the difference and didn't revisit the business model. Also in 2001, Majuba Colliery closed, and as the previous witness said, all Eskom's mines are supplied by a tied colliery. And this was the first one of the major new power stations where the colliery seemingly could not deliver the coal at the required price and was summarily closed. That created the need to buy in coal. For the first time in Eskom's life, it had to then sort of go to the open market and source coal for Majuba Colliery, all 15 million tons a year of it. And certainly that created major new problems for Eskom and issues to have to comply with. And so that ended up in it being overstretched in terms of its governance and its compliance capabilities. Eskom didn't have delivery mechanisms, didn't have proof of delivery mechanisms, didn't have weighbridges, didn't have labs to assess the stuff. So they immediately started buying stuff from the open market, and they had no control mechanisms in place. Also in 2001, the Eskom medium-term coal procurement was thus formulated, and that was to give Eskom coal division a mandate to go and buy coal on the open market on an emergency basis without tenders, and as it eventuated, without even written documents. A lot of this stuff was just done verbally, and that opened up the space for corruption. And my estimate is that that's where the corruption started. It might have started at a small scale, but it certainly started at that stage and under those conditions. Of course, that was also a breach of the PFMA. And again, the Eskom board and the governance structures did not pick that up. To this day, so it's now 17 years later, or 16 years later, the PFMA is still being breached by Eskom because they're still buying coal on the open market when there are other more cost-effective alternatives available. It is also my contention that the breaching of the PFMA is the activity that allows all this corruption on the coal procurement side certainly to fester and for coal prices to be 2, 3, 4, 5 times higher than what they should have been. In 2004, after the failure of the implementation of the white paper on private ownership of power stations, the government ordered Eskom to build a new power station. And the reason that why it failed apparently was because the private investors felt that the returns that the government was prepared to contemplate were too low for commercial operation. I then want to take this committee to the 2005 annual report, where a review was done on the fact that Eskom was now going to build these power stations. And in that report, under the chairman's report, as well as the director's report, there is mentioned that a five-year capital outlook for four power plants amounted to 93 billion rand. And that's a very significant number. 93 billion for four power plants. What you saw eventuating over the next 5 years was three of those power projects. I'm not sure what happened to the fourth. But certainly Medupi, we all know, Kusile, we all know, and Ngula, we all know. So in 2005, they estimated that the CapEx would be 93 billion in total, and preparations for the rollout of this CapEx started. From 2005 onwards, it's also significant to note that McKinsey was appointed, as well as Accenture. And this is something that also needs to be noted, that not only those two companies, but many other companies thrive off continual renewal of the Eskom contracts. Everybody was crying about KPMG festering and having an incestuous relationship. This is pervasive in the SOEs. All the large auditing companies have lots of contact with Eskom, even when they are not under tender to do the audits. All the large firms have lots of contact with Eskom. And in fact, I would like to put it on record that to the best of my knowledge, there's at least 100 forensic reviews and reports and investigations within Eskom every year. Those reports, a lot of them are hidden. When they don't point out the right person as on the witch hunt, they seem to disappear and get hidden. Or if it's too politically sensitive, they get hidden. This committee needs to get access to all those reports, either via Eskom or via the service providers who provided those. And it would be all the auditing companies and certainly all the law firms, all the top five law firms. It's also significant that, given that McKinsey has been involved with Eskom, that 12 years later, they're still involved with Eskom. So it's a relationship that seemed to be a marriage rather than a date, because it just keeps on getting bigger and bigger and bigger and more incestuous and more incestuous and more incestuous. And I would have thought that if somebody's a turnaround specialist, it would take you a little bit shorter than 12 years to achieve your goal. So these end up as from single contracts to multi-billion rand contracts that just roll over and escalate every year. And in fact, at one stage when I was inside Eskom for my third period, I noted that a lot of the work was being done by these companies and not Eskom staff. And these activities related from procurement training to coal planning to turnarounds and everything in between. I don't think it's a healthy situation. In 2006, despite what the previous witness indicated, as far as I could see, and I have documentation in this regard, the first major fraud on buying coal was detected. There's a Deloitte report about this matter. The Deloitte report totals it up at about 100 million. My private industry whistleblowers indicated that the problem was as big as 450 million. It involved bribery of labs, which then resulted in fake results for the coal specifications. I have a letter in my possession, which is available to the committee, and in fact is in the committee's hands, where BHP offers to settle its portion of the bribery and corruption for 80 million rand. That was given to Eskom. Eskom did not activate that. So the 80 million rand didn't get to Eskom's pocket as compensation for the bribery and corruption which penalized Eskom. That matter was also raised with Minister Hogan. It was tabled in Parliament, but it seems to me Minister Hogan moved on before the matter was sorted out. So that was in 2006. I'm also aware that in 2007, Eskom had to write off more than 400,000 tons of coal, which it had paid for, but they couldn't find. Now, to give you an indication of 400,000 tons of coal, as the previous witness has indicated, is a large stockpile of coal. It's about 7 rugby fields full, about the height of a tree. It's not easy to miss. Yet Eskom had to pay for coal, 400,000 tons, which they couldn't find. And that was in 2007. So the current issues about fraud and corruption didn't start yesterday. They've been around for quite a while. Also in 2007, I'm aware of the appointment of HR, human resource partners, or labor brokers, both local and overseas. Some of those issues have hit the papers in terms of court cases, in terms of some certain labor brokers, where kickbacks were paid to Eskom staff. Others remain secret. This committee needs to investigate how many kickbacks Eskom executives took from labor brokers and HR firms to go and look for senior executives under the expatriate program, where they brought people back from around the world to boost Eskom's skills and others. And this was the first time that I became aware of the 3 times that I was at Eskom the kickback culture seemed to have indoctrinated into the system. And I'm certainly aware that it happened at in the human resources division. The motivation for these recruitment of all these foreign people who were then, or locals who then had left South Africa, was to help with the new build, because as the previous witness indicated, they embarked on this new build with an Eskom that had had no experience for more than 20 years of building new power stations, and yet opted to do the contract management itself without any of the guarantees that were available in terms of cost and delays under a turnkey arrangement that Eskom previously have tried to implement. So this put Eskom firmly at risk for these new build projects. In December 2007, the medium-term coal procurement mandate that I alluded to earlier on, that was implemented in 2001 for 6 years, to buy in coal for Majuba Colliery, which was not functioning, expired. What had come to my attention at that time is, besides the fact that no tendering was used under this mandate, and a lot of coal was bought in without documentation, is that a lot of people were making a lot of money out of this flagrant disregard of proper governance and procedures. I did a book, Back of the Cigarette Box Estimation, because I was asked to do that, and my quick calculation indicated that it amounted to billions of rands that Eskom was unnecessarily spending on the coal account. And it involved fictitious coal purchases as well as fictitious transport arrangements. And certain people became very, very rich out of that. I'm also aware that Eskom has a forensic report on that. That forensic report was never tabled. It was hidden away. Also in my possession is a schedule which indicates and highlights how prior to December 2007, when the mandate was had expired, and there was an argument between Eskom Generation and Eskom Finance as to whether that mandate should be renewed, how the coal stockpiles dropped. So it didn't take a genius to see that we were heading for a load shedding situation. And that was very clear even in December 2007, which is a month before the load shedding of 2008 happened. That eventually led to the departure of the executive head of finance, Mr. Nkubaba, because he couldn't contemplate having this mandate rolled over or extended because of the excessive fraud and corruption that had been breeding under the guise of this mandate. That mandate was renewed in August 2008 for another 6 years. I also discovered at that time the East-West transport scam. And that is where coal was allegedly purchased in the east, near Majuba, but transport costs showed that it had to go to all the way to the west, to Kendall. In the meantime, that transport didn't take place. The coal was delivered at Majuba, but Eskom paid for the transport. That was part of the billions of rands that I picked up in wasteful and fraudulent expenditure. So come January the 15th, 2008, when I was shown the stock sheet, I wasn't shown this exact one that I have in my possession now, which I've made available to the committee, but I was shown a similar one, and I saw that we were inches from a blackout. That was the Tuesday. I then wrote an email to my boss, Mr. Nkababa, who forwarded to Mr. Damas and the executive, indicating that we were inches away from a national blackout because of coal shortages. The message I got back from the executive, unfortunately it was verbal, was that I should shut up and stop being an alarmist. I went from there to Macro and I went and purchased my generator. So I was one of the first person to buy a generator because I could see there was a problem coming. That email is available. On Friday the 18th, South Africa was plunged into darkness. At that stage, there was no Eskom remedy or recovery plan because the coal stockpiles had dropped. I believe that having known that information, even though as late as 4 days before, ancillary steps could have been taken to put teams of coal miners on overtime and try and boost the stockpiles, even on an emergency basis. As I alluded to you earlier, there had been a standoff between generation and finance. And there is correspondence available, and Eskom should have that correspondence. The rolling blackouts then carried on for months, and a coal crisis committee was established. I was nominated to be a member of that coal crisis committee. And all I can say about it is that at best, it started off as a very amateur effort. Because of my criticism of that committee, I was removed by management. What came apparent from the coal shortages during the 2008 blackouts is that Eskom staff were involved with blatant front-running. Maybe I need to quickly explain that. I went out on a limb to try and get Eskom extra coal, given that it was a national emergency. I was offered coal, for example, 55 rand a ton. Eskom declined that coal. Behind my back, they went to the coal supplier and offered to buy the coal at 110 rand a ton. And pocketed the difference. Some Eskom staff got very rich during this period of time because it amounted to a doubling of the cost of coal. In August 2008, my supervisor and the person who hired me, Mr. Nkubaba, leaves. At that time, we were talking about extending my contract for 10 years because I had background knowledge of what had happened or what should happen on the coal side. The night before my new contract was supposed to commence, I got a phone call at 8 o'clock in the evening cancelling my new contract for 10 years. No notice. I was told that certain people, including the executive of Eskom, didn't want me around to expose more corruption. I also believe I'm the grandfather of exposing corruption within Eskom, and you can go and Google that, because in January 2009, I went public with all the corruption that I had uncovered at Eskom. I firmly believe that the corruption was done under the extension of the medium-term coal procurement mandate, which was then extended for another 6 years. And incidentally, that expired in 2014 when the country again had national blackouts. You need to tie the dots. So I believe that after the second mandate was put in place, the coal frauds hit what I call second gear, or the second generation of fraudulent corruption. The first guys were basically perhaps informed that they'd made enough money, I'm not sure, but there seemed to be a new generation that succeeded the first generation at the troughs. I'm fully aware of optimum coal frauds, where Optimum was complaining about its low price, sold coal to BEEs to double the price, because that was the prevailing pattern in Eskom. If you were BEE, you were offered double the coal price of what the traditional mining houses were offered. And then what happened was that Optimum then arbitraged the difference in the extra profit. And that is why Optimum was, for the records that will be seen, short supplying on coal. So they're short supplying on coal under the contract, but oversupplying on through the back door. And ironically, all the coal still stayed on the conveyor. So there were no extra transport costs. 2018 to have been a busy time in Eskom's life, because at that time, the Medupi quotes also came out. Correctly or incorrectly, I was asked, because of my previous involvement at Eskom as head of the consulting unit, we did tender evaluation at that time, before it went to Treasury seemingly, I was asked for my input on the quotes, and I recall seeing a quote for Medupi, for the Powers Island as they call it, in other words the turbines and the boilers, for roughly 32 billion rand. I thought I was mad when people kept on asking me whether I hadn't pressed, made a mistake. I've recently verified that number of 32 billion rand, plus or minus a couple of bob. For various reasons, that seemed to be a limited tender. I would also say that from the information that I've subsequently obtained, past 2008, that I have no doubt in my mind that the Hitachi tender was rigged. We've heard this morning that the Hitachi was not the first winner of the tender. The tender content was rigged under the second exercise, where Hitachi was then brought in to participate on the tender. We have documentary evidence of that. It's also pertinent to mention that Siemens had apparently, given the crisis of the rollouts all over, Siemens had offered to immediately make available units off the shelf to attend to the perceived crisis, but they were rejected. And that letter came via Minister Alec Irwin. The offer went to the Minister, Mr. Alec Irwin, but for some other reason it never saw the light of day, and they were not invited to tender either. Needless to say, I was totally gobsmacked when at the end of December 2008, I saw that the Medupi tender, which I had previously seen at 32 billion for the Power Island, was confirmed at the Eskom board, which I thought was 91 billion, but we were told this morning was 92 billion. More than three times higher than what I had seen originally. This new tender or contract also included Chancellor House via Hitachi. I believe that there was clear prima facie evidence that this tender was manipulated. Ironically, at the same time, the Kusile contract was announced without a tender. It was also issued around about 91 billion rand, if my memory serves me correct. It also seemingly involved Chancellor House, if my memory serves me correct. And we're told that the reason there was no tender was because Eskom had suddenly decided that they had a new fleet strategy of duplicating the same units and the same suppliers. Whereas previously, Eskom's fleet strategy was not to replicate the tenders on successive bids, because if there was an inherent flaw in the tender or the design, it would obviate that being replicated. I've asked Eskom for a copy of the new fleet strategy to see when it was originated. I have not been able to get that. Ironically, as I said, 2008-2009 seems to be a very busy timeline in Eskom, because at that time there was also a nuclear bid, which the previous speaker alluded to, and that was by Areva. And that was cancelled after Polokwane. I don't know what the correlation is between Polokwane and the cancellation of the nuclear deal with Areva. My best information was that that was offered at a turnkey price of around 40 cents a kilowatt hour, which in today's money looks like it was very cheap, but you'll have to evaluate that. I was also subsequently informed by French television that members of the President's Council sold uranium reserves to Areva in the belief that they were going to get this bid for $2.5 billion. That has never been publicly raised before. I have a document from the Canadian Parliament confirming their investigation into this $2.5 billion wasteful expenditure by Areva. Areva is out of pocket after believing that it could recoup the money if the deal was clinched. That is currently an issue in the French Parliament. In 2010, we had the World Cup, as was previously mentioned this morning, and I believe Eskom made a policy of lights on at all costs. To maintain that, Eskom stopped maintenance of plant. And we heard from a previous CEO of Eskom, Mr. Molefe, that when he got to Eskom, the maintenance had still not been recovered. And he then involved or invited or discovered Tetris to sort out the maintenance backlog issue. The question I have to this committee is, what happened to the maintenance budget of more than 10 billion rand a year between 2010 and 2014 for maintenance that didn't happen? Surely if you don't do the maintenance, you should have that money spare somewhere, in a provision account or in your bank account or something. Now, one of the members previously talked about the missing 20 billion on the maintenance account. Well, it's probably closer to 40 billion if next to no maintenance was done, although I believe that some maintenance would have had to be done. So Mr. Molefe and co. comes to Eskom around about 2014 and finds that the plants are all run down, and he starts his Tetris program of maintenance upgrades. During that time, availability at Eskom's plant also fell dramatically, and Eskom stopped publishing its availability of its plant. To this day, we've not been able to get Eskom to tell us what the availability is on a month-to-month basis, despite numerous requests. Lo and behold, 2014, we have some more national roading blackouts. And this time the diesel units are ramped up. When diesels purchased at more than 16 rand a litre versus 5 rand a litre landed cost. So the gravy train is still running strongly at Eskom. As I alluded to earlier on, 2014 was also the year when the medium-term coal procurement mandate had expired. With the renewal of that for another 6 years, if I'm correctly informed, we saw the involvement of the Guptas as the third generation of benefactors from high coal prices. Maybe the blackouts were also meant to coincide with the signing of the nuclear deal, which we all read about in the court papers last year. At that time also, Togeta approached Eskom again, and this time was successful in starting to sell coal to Eskom, or what they call coal, it's not necessarily coal, at very high prices. I want to take the committee to 2017 and inform you that at the Eskom results, there was no mention made of the 3 billion irregular expenditure. In fact, a very rosy picture was painted by the then new acting CEO, Mr. Ladler, about Eskom's financial position, and Mr. Singh. I picked up and went on carte blanche. I was invited to go into carte blanche, where I broke the news about the 3 billion irregular expenditure. I also accentuated that the profits were down for a reason. Money was disappearing out the back door. We then proposed questions to Mr. Blattler as the CEO, because they couldn't take them in the analyst meeting. They reckoned they were too complicated and too long. That letter was dated the 1st of August. Today is the 18th of October, and I'm still waiting for an answer from Eskom on the queries we had in terms of the cost of the power stations and coal costs. In 2017, NERSA held hearings about Eskom's application to keep its coal costs secret. We believe we won that hearing when NERSA determined that Eskom must make the information available. And Eskom was instructed to improve transparency and provide improved information on coal. It seems to me, unbeknown to you and me and the public at large, that NERSA held another secret meeting on the 4th of September where there's no minutes and seemingly no written decision, where they decided that Eskom should continue with the secrecy. Now that, from a public point of view, is totally, totally unacceptable. Against the background of all the corruption that's been exposed over the last 3 years, it's even more unacceptable. And we cannot allow this country to carry on this basis. I'd like to draw the committee's attention to the other shortcomings. There's a big problem with the multi-year price determination formulas that are applied by NERSA. Because every year when Eskom, or every time Eskom formulates the target future price increase, they guesstimate future growth requirements. I suspect the Eskom works backwards. They work out how much profit they want to bag, and then they temper the forecast sales accordingly. Because even in this current MYPD, Eskom's forecasts are substantially higher than even National Treasury's forecasts in terms of future growth. And as soon as those are adopted, Eskom is guaranteed profits, whether it delivers electricity or not. I believe there's a structure of tariffs. The incline block tariffs are totally uncompetitive, and I've lodged a complaint at the Competition Commission. They are penalizing large sectors of the economy, including the agricultural sector, who pay exorbitant prices, whether they take electricity or not. They have to pay line fees. And the other thing is, these line fees, which are deadlines, there's nothing much going on with them. The increases on their cost increases the same as the coal cost increases, and that cannot be true. There's also a major problem with the other distribution cost increases that Eskom puts forward, and we believe that the forensic investigation is necessary as that. As far as NERSA's behavior, it saddens me to have to say, is NERSA captured? Is NERSA captured? In 2013, they approved a price increase of roughly 25% for Eskom. Because it was an election year, after interference from the president, and that's documented in the papers, the price increase was dropped by more than 10%. Now how in heaven's name do you drop a price by 10% after you've gone through this whole regulatory process of justifying the higher price? How can you overnight give a 10% discount? I would be ashamed if I was an NERSA. 2017, the lack of transparency continues. And I believe under the NYPD is currently being run, there is collusion between Eskom and NERSA. And our records prove it. We've got written proof of that. We believe the irregular expenditure of $3 billion is a drop in the ocean. There's more irregular expenditure. Something that's previously not been highlighted, and I highlight it now for the first time ever, is that Eskom has been dabbling with derivatives, with our money, the public's money. And what they haven't told you is their losses to date, as at the financial year end, was 27 billion rand. And I'm sure this committee is not aware of that. Who did they appoint? They appointed Trillion. So Trillion is taking our money inside Eskom's treasury and gambling with it on forex and all sorts of things and making losses, because it doesn't matter to them, because they get commission. And the commission under the current financial year up to March this year was 4 billion rand. Not million, billion. And we have a forensic report to verify that. If you look at Eskom's performance, the previous incumbent talked about the fantastic ability to borrow more money. But if you look at the graph very closely, you'll see that it comes on the back of major revaluations in asset base, which of course is inspired by the faulty MYPD methodology. So Eskom's asset base goes from 200 billion, which I think is a more or less a more correct figure, to over 743 billion without finishing any new projects other than in Gouda. So how does the assets value go from 200 billion up to 700 billion when it's still the same assets that were worth 200 billion? And this was financially engineered by Eskom so that they can go and borrow more money against these so-called revalued assets. So the debt in Eskom from 2005, remember we talked about 2005, was less than 14 billion. The total debt in Eskom now is closer to 480 billion. including the 350 and the government guarantee. So what they've done is they've revalued the assets, and on the back of that they've gone and borrowed every single penny they could, and that's why they can't even afford to service the debt and interest at the moment. This is deliberate financial manipulation. In the industry they call it engineering, financial engineering, but this is nothing short of manipulation. Also at the time, in 2005, Eskom said that because of the difficulties in the financial markets, they couldn't raise money for the new build in terms of debt. So they said they would increase the tariff, and that's where the first 35% tariff increase came. Well, that was followed by further excessive increases. And if I take you to this graph, you'll see that over the period of time, Eskom needs to account to us for a missing trillion rand. Where does the trillion rand come from? Roughly 800 billion is from excessive price increases. 83 billion is from conversion of the government debt or loan into equity. And another 480 billion is the borrowed money that they increased from 2005 to 2017. And they still want to borrow more. So somewhere, somebody needs to explain to us why we're paying so much money for electricity and what happened to the extra trillion rand that went through Eskom's treasury without value. If we then correlate that to prices, Madam Chair, we are currently paying roughly 86 cents a kilowatt hour. With this new increase, we'll go to about 1 rand 7 cents a kilowatt hour. If we go back to 2005 and escalate the proper price of electricity, without all this fictitious and fallacious and corrupt increases, we get to no more than 30 cents a kilowatt hour. I would propose to this committee that if electricity today was 30 cents a kilowatt hour, we would have a booming economy with no unemployment or very little unemployment and lots of exports and a positive balance of payments. One company has been allowed to wreck the South African economy, create millions of people in the jobless sector, and an economic growth rate that splutters below 1% per annum. If Eskom's current application is accepted, they accept in the application that it's going to cost another 185,000 jobs per year over the next 5 years, because they want another 20% a year for the next 5 years, on top of what they've already misappropriated. I don't think this country can afford it. I was then asked to indicate some of the key players that came out of our previous presentation. It'll take me 1 second. I'm going to run through them very quickly. People that need to be brought to book include Mr. Noosh Singh. And we all know now from the newspapers what his record is, so I want this to go into the record. Secondly, Mr. Richard Seleke and his role in the Gupta Mails and the Optimum transaction and the trips to Dubai. Thirdly, Mr. Kokko, who I believe is currently going through disciplinaries, but that doesn't seem to be happening. And Mr. Kokko also has a lot to be to answer to, including the coal sale agreement or coal purchase agreement at exceptionally high prices, 3 times higher, 300% higher than what was previously the case at Optimum. Then I was also asked by the investigating legal team to put together a to-do list. And I would ask, and I really think that this committee's work will not be done if they don't put together a task force to do divisional and corporate recommendations and analysis within Eskom. We can't allow this company to carry on, and it's not capable of fixing itself. I think there needs to be a reassessment of the governance structure within Eskom. It was clearly, since 2001, as I've indicated, when they changed the company from a statute company to a company under the Companies Act, the governance flew out of the window. I would urge this committee to consider granting amnesty to those people who are implicated, because I'm aware of another 1,000 frauds within Eskom which have not been highlighted in this presentation. And those people will not come forward if they are going to implicate themselves. So I would plead for an amnesty so that we can get to the bottom of this and clean up Eskom. Without getting all the dirt, we're not going to be able to clean up the organization. I believe that this approach for amnesty and for investigation should happen in waves. We need to start at the executive, the board, then go to the next layer, and then down the next layer. Because the corruption goes right down to project management level, at the power plants, where tenders are being given for instance, at Medupi, there is a food tender that a certain member of the ANC executive, NEC, his family supplies the food for more than 1.4 billion rand a year. Now, if that's not a conflict of interest, then I don't know what is, because that Medupi will never be finished building as long as that food tender is still in place. And I think, ultimately, this committee needs to resolve to bring the crooks to book. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Mr. Blom. That's the presentation that we get today with all timelines. I am now expecting hands. Mr. Singh, your hand was up. Mr. Swart, Mr. Buyenge, Ms. Magon, Ms. Shivambo. All of you. All right, all of you. One line. Mr. Singh, could you start?
Thank you very much. Quick questions, and unfortunately I'll have to leave at 2 o'clock for another meeting. I didn't think to get too early on, so thank you for giving me the first one. First of all, Mr. Blom, thank you for your presentation, previously and now. And I ask this question of everybody else because we'd like to ascertain the credibility of the witnesses, not only for their sake, but for the credibility of our process. Do you have any axe to grind against anybody within Eskom or in government? You were employed by Eskom, and can you just briefly give us the circumstances why you were removed from there? This morning you had Mr. Damas do a presentation. I take it that you were dismissed during, if that's the right word, during his time. Can you just speak to what he had to say, firstly? Secondly, I take it you were in charge of facilitating contracts, for coal contracts and other contracts during your term of office. Were you called by anybody other than the tender committee, the legitimate tender committee, to talk about contracts, to favor certain person or persons? The forensic report that you referred to in your presentation, can we request that be made available to the committee with regard to the 4 billion rand commission, the losses on the derivatives? You said there is a report that will help us. You also said that NERSA captured, and you haven't given us an answer. But if there's any evidence that you have which would suggest that NERSA, because I certainly, as a member of this committee, place a lot of emphasis on the role that NERSA performs, especially in bringing down the proposed tariff increases that are requested by Eskom. So I'll be very disappointed if there's any evidence to suggest that NERSA have been captured, but if you can please hand that over to us. Then you spoke about Areva and members of the President's Council sold uranium reserves in your presentation. Who is this President's Council? Do you know who makes up the President's Council? And my last question, so that I give you time to respond, I think I know who you're referring to when you talk about the tender, food tender, because that was public knowledge. The Medupi 32 billion to 92 billion, manipulated by whom and how? Thank you, Chairman.
Can we do them one at a time, please, madam? I'm a bit slow in my writing. Thank you very much for those questions, Honourable Member. I was on a 2-year contract, so the contract terminated because of time, from 2006 to 2008. However, Eskom had asked me to, and the finance directorate had asked me to extend my contract by 10 years so that I could implement some of the recommendations that I'd made in order to stomp out the corruption that I had become aware of. And that is, so I have no axe to grind with Eskom. In fact, if I had an axe to grind, I would have taken them to court because I had lots of evidence of the extension of the contract. But I believe that if you're not wanted at a place, as this previous witness this morning also said, then it's best to take your leave and to move on. However, I couldn't take leave of the corruption that I'd witnessed. And so that's why I went public. And I went so public that eventually the current president, when he was out of parliament, made himself available for a meeting because he made notes at that time that he was going to be corruption fighter number one. And I went to a meeting at his house in Forest Town at 11 o'clock at night.
You mean current President Zuma?
That's right.
Okay.
Where we indicated to Mr. Zuma a brief report on what corruption we were aware of within Eskom, and he undertook to stomp out that corruption because he was going to be corruption fighter number one. Weeks after that, I was invited to a secret meeting in Midrand also, incidentally, but not at Sahara Computers, where I met a so-called fixer team. There were six people in this meeting who were so-called Mr. Zuma's fixer team. And this was, as we were meeting, the lights went out. And the fixer team first question to me was, given my extensive experience of Eskom, how could they also join, if I had to use my own words, the gravy train? I was totally shocked by this because I was introduced to this team as a group of very eminent people, highly qualified. Some were professors, some were doctors, some were legal people, and I don't know what all. Unfortunately, I didn't take note of that meeting because it didn't last for very long. I was... No, that's not in
those. You have names?
No, it's not those people. So that meeting didn't last very long because I was so disgusted that I said to the people, my mission was to fix up Eskom, not to mess it up further. And I took my leave after I insulted the people. And as I was driving away, my cell phone rang and I was told, these are such senior people, how dare you insult them? And I said to the person who had organized the meeting, my parents told me I don't have to tolerate scum. And I never had anything further to do with that meeting.
You don't have names of any of them?
No, I only have the name of the coordinator.
You can put it onto the record.
The person who organized that meeting was the former chairman of the JSE, Mr. Norman Lowenthal.
I don't think he's finished answering, Jefferson. I don't think he's finished answering the questions.
Okay, so the next part of the questions I've got it here is the payment of $2.5 billion to persons connected with the Areva bid. The person that was on the President's Council that was allegedly involved with mining and mineral affairs at the time was Mr. Sam Joner. Then in terms of the price increase of Medupi, the price increased from Medupi from 32 odd billion, and I say odd because it's in that ballpark, to 92 billion or 91 billion. That was orchestrated by Eskom. That was orchestrated by Eskom, and we subsequently got documents, which we visited over 100,000 documents, which we've got access to. We've had a look at that and we believe we can build a strong case around that. Sorry, is there any more?
NASA, you made some assertions about NASA.
Sorry, okay, absolutely. It breaks my heart to have to make these assertions about NASA. But the fact of the matter is, they agreed that we were correct to ask for transparency. They made a decision. That decision's public knowledge. That they said to Eskom that they need to increase the transparency. Then on the 4th of September, we then got the NYPD document, which had large pages blocked out. When I approached them and said this isn't in accordance with the decision where I had testified, they told me that they'd subsequently taken a decision for commercial reasons to carry on blocking out the so-called sensitive information. And when I asked them on what basis they were blocking this out further, they then alluded to an interim meeting, which we found out was on the 4th of September, for which there seems to be no minutes. And we then asked for a copy of Eskom's request for the secrecy, or the written copy of the decision, and none of those documentation has been forthcoming to my email.
Chair, finally, if we can be presented with the forensic on the 4 billion rand commission on the derivatives that you spoke about.
Certainly, that's available.
Thank you, Chair. I don't have a long history with the committee, but I do remember your previous presentation, and thank you for that lengthy documentation that you provided us. Now, you've given us summaries, and a lot of what you've said is to me startling and shocking. But clearly it would be helpful for you to present a lengthy document with annexes as far as possible, similar to the other ARTA documents that you provided. Because you've referred to, we've got documents, we've got documents. And so, as far as you are able to maybe provide us with a more lengthy statement on the slides that you've provided, because the slides are very brief, and we'd like to obviously interrogate these issues. For me, it's historical, and you've gone back to show that corruption at Eskom has been around a long time. It just seems to have reached a third level or even a higher level now, and we need to be aware of that. So we need to obtain that information. I'd like you also just to unpack, how is it possible that 400,000 tons of coal disappears? It must be there somewhere. Has it been stolen? And that just seems to indicate a lack of due process. And this goes back to a period when we thought Eskom was being properly run. Now, you're also obviously aware that there have been a number of investigations. There's so many different investigations. And one of the most pertinent is the SIU investigation into coal procurement from up to 2012. And that investigation is finalized. So to what degree have you cooperated with various of these investigations by providing information to them? And also, of course, to Parliament. Is this the first time this information has been provided to Parliament to help exercise its oversight role? I don't know. I'm not in this committee. But obviously a lot of what you're saying is startling and I'm sure that parties that you've mentioned will want to respond to the allegations that you made, such as the Optimum Mines, the front running you referred to, that you've referred to fronting as well, and then of course you've also referred to the diesel purchases, which to me is astounding. If it's 5 rand landed costs and we've been charged, and that was it 8 billion for that year or something ridiculous for that figure?
Number 10.
So we need more information so that we can interrogate that. We've got lots of reports that might be, but from your perspective of presenting this, you've got the inside knowledge, you were there, and it's very helpful to us as we engage in looking at this. But clearly, as you look at the situation now, the chairman indicated it's a crisis. It's a financial crisis. You've indicated a few aspects of looking into some of that. So one of the suggestions is an amnesty. But I've got a major concern with that, because you've got corruption that has taken place. How do you decide who you're going to give amnesty to? Yes, at some stage, the criminal investigation authorities are going to approach some people and say, turn state witness. But you yourself, as ARTA, are engaged in a case against the police and the Hawks for not doing their work. So how do you assist us in who do we grant amnesty to? If a person comes to Parliament and gives evidence under oath and they are truthful, there is a possibility. But this broad corruption, please unpack that a little bit for us. Then just on the financials that you unpack now, the situation now, one of our mandates is to look into the financial sustainability of Eskom. And I'd like you to unpack that a little bit more of what you said, where you said the asset base is too low, but going forward, we need to bring out a report on where is Eskom going to. So you'd like to possibly, our time is limited now, but give us more documentation as to where you are thinking the financial model should be going. Thank you, Chair.
Well, Thank you very much, Honourable Member. The good news is in your email, there should be a 90-page document supporting some of the stuff that was discussed this morning. But obviously with the evidence leader, there's more work to be done. Some of the emails are on file. Some of the incriminating documents are on file, either with ATA or with the evidence leader. So some of the documentation will eventually arrive. But you're talking about 17 years worth of documentation, so it's not going to be that easy. Secondly, 400,000 tons of coal, or roughly 7 soccer fields or rugby fields full of coal. It's a pity you didn't ask that question to the previous witness, because it was during his tenure, and him as a scientist and a specialist and CEO of the organization might have been able to give you a better answer than I can. All I know is that Eskom paid for the coal and wrote the coal off because they couldn't find it. And that is, I think, due to either corruption or bad management practices, that they were paying proof of deliveries where coal was not delivered. And I'm aware of instances where people were in the queue delivering coal by road, paid the Eskom official $50, didn't deliver the coal, then went back into the queue. In other words, got about 3 or 4 times paid for one delivery of coal. That was quite rampant at that stage. Or not even coal, but stone. A lot of the stuff doesn't qualify as coal. I've never been approached by any of the investigative units to testify or offer my evidence. I've offered my evidence to NERSA on several occasions. They have not made use of that. I would have thought that NERSA as a regulator should have the capacity to, in fact, just at least have a look at some of the evidence. That never happened. Neither the SIU.
Nothing. No. SIU.
In terms of the amnesty proposal, my problem is, and the reason why I propose that, is that Eskom's corruption is now so widespread. If I had to make an estimate right now as to how many incidences of corruption have happened this year at Eskom, I would say at least 1,000. And I say that from an educated point of view, because I'm aware of corruption with brown envelopes going on every single week at some of the Eskom offices. And the corruption, as I said, isn't happening only at head office. It's happening at Medupi, it's happening at Kusili, it's happening at other power stations, it's happening with laundry services, it's happening with garden services, where people are nominated by third force agents as to who should win these tenders. If we open up a whistleblowing thing, and I've already got some whistleblowers coming through to me, my inbox will just overflow, because of literally thousands of transgressions every year of what would be considered reasonable or good governance. So that's why I'm asking for amnesty, because only then will we get exposed to the full size. At the moment it's all hidden. You hear about here, you hear about there, because you've got excellent journalists that hide behind corners and under tables and so on to spy on these Eskom people doing the corrupt businesses. But believe you me, there is far more. Only the sensational stuff is getting to the press at the moment. There's far more, and it's hundreds of millions of rands. In terms of the financials, certainly, I don't think that Eskom is financially sustainable, and certainly not without guarantees, and that's a fact, because without the government guarantees, Eskom wouldn't be able to raise one penny. In terms of Eskom having to, and Eskom burns about 7 billion rand a month. That's roughly what they're burning at the moment, over and above what they're getting in from income. So to the extent that Eskom is not able to fund that billion, the 7 billion, which is about 60, 70 billion a year, off the market, and nobody wants to invest in Eskom at the moment, and I think the PIC will stop investing in Eskom very soon as well, correctly so, because Eskom has no prospect of paying back that money. So I think the situation financially Eskom is precarious, and when the evidence leader approaches me again, I'll certainly provide the best of my information to corroborate that.
Thank you, Chairperson. Seemingly, Mr. Blom, you've long been at Eskom, and with special reference to the period you started to talk about say, from 2000, you have mentioned a lot of instances of this nature. Maybe do you think even before 2000, there were other activities, corrupt activities that were taking place at ESCOM? And I want to maybe understand you, as you have actually suggested an amnesty. It is because of the volume of the type of work that relates to this corruption that is actually unearthing itself, because this is a manifestation of what is happening at ESCOM in as far as what you are saying. Now, where do you think this money is going to? By the look of things, there is billions in circulation in this country. And then can you maybe make a suggestion as to how best can we know the individuals? Is the majority locals or international people that are coming from the globe milking the billions from our country? So if the rot that exists in ESCOM, even in other entities, there is, then it means we have a problem. And the open mechanism that you are using to provide this information requires maybe a little bit more of evidence, but that evidence might not necessarily does not necessarily maybe equal an amnesty. The level of it may be the majority of those people are wealthy people, because I don't think the poor at home, the poor masses of our country, are actually benefiting out of this. How do you then think this affects the poorest of the poor? What level do you think this affects the poor masses of our country? Because this entity is the entity that we actually want to see it being a tool of a democratic of a developmental state that we want, where the entities are supposed to be. Then is there what is the level of effect of this to the poor?
Thank you very much, honourable member. I'll try my best to answer. If I can start at the end, if the poor were benefiting from all this corruption, I guess they'd no longer be poor. But the cost to the economy is between 2 and 6% a year in growth. If ESCOM's allowed to carry on with its current NYPD, they admit their numbers, not my numbers, their numbers, an extra 185,000 jobs lost every year for the next 5 years. That's on top of the millions of jobs lost since 2007, when this stupid excessive regime of pricing took place for the first time. This means that there would be some hope for the 70% unemployed under 35-year-olds in this country, who have never had the honor of getting a salary at the end of the month, ever in their lives, which I think is a gross human violation. So certainly this corruption is having a massive impact on this economy. And I believe there's not one person in this house who doesn't know of somebody, a family member, who hasn't struggled to find a job because of the lack of growth in this economy, the joblessness because the money is not going into the investment, it's going out the back door. You're asking me where the money goes. Well, I think we all know that some of the large money is going through offshore, through various bank accounts, whether it's Bank of Baroda or other banks or how it's going, or through fictitious invoicing or whatever. So I think the large money is going offshore. But there's still millions that's going into local corrupt practices. I mean, places like Bitbank, Middleburg, with the regional operations of Eskimoa. Even on the transmission and distribution, we have evidence of corruption taking place in tender allocation and so on, happening at Foster Arts and so forth and so on. So that's why I say it's widespread. And you ask me, why? How will an amnesty work? Isn't it too wide? Well, then maybe it's a conditional amnesty. I'm not an expert on amnesties, and maybe this house needs to think in the client's mind as to how a selective amnesty, or maybe you do it in tiers, like the tax people do. You say all those people are aware of big corruption. If you want amnesty, you've got 60 days in which to come and declare to the house. And then you go from, you know, smaller amounts and smaller amounts until you get at least the 80% of the corruption exposed. And I agree that it's painful, even to me, to have a corrupt person ask for amnesty. But unless you get some of the, if you get half of the corrupt people, at least you're winning half of the game, whereas at the moment you're not winning the game at all. So my conscience is that I'm also not mad about amnesties, because it benefits some of the corruptors, but at the end of the day, you're not going to get to the bottom of this if you don't create an incentive for people to come forward and blow the whistle on their own conduct and their colleagues.
Does that include the price fixing or by the service providers of Eskom?
Oh, certainly. I mean, the way that the pricing structure works, it's affecting everybody. Firstly, the fact that the prices are three times higher than what they should be affects everybody. You and I could be consuming and buying three times more electricity for the money that it costs us. But that's what we see at the basic level. If you go to incline block 1 and 2 and 3, to the higher incline blocks, you are probably paying five times higher for your electricity than what the base tariff is. And so that's about 15 times higher than what the electricity price should be. So yes, the poor are also affected because they can't afford electricity. So their children can't study by electricity light. They have to study by candlelight. They're suffering in the winter, the cold, the water, the wind. They're not living a decent standard of living because they can't afford. And as the previous witness said, electricity forms more than 90% of your life. If you take electricity out now, 90% of your life will not carry on the same as what it did yesterday. So it's really critically important to the economy, for jobs, for standards of living, for education, for economic growth, for everything. It's a core part of our livelihoods.
Talk to the indebtedness now, the indebtedness of Eskom. That's my last take, sir.
Okay, so Eskom's debt has gone from roughly 14 billion in 2005 to 480-odd billion, of which 350-odd is guaranteed by the government. The fact of the matter is they've borrowed 480 billion rand or 470 billion rand more than what they had in 2005. And remember, right when we started the slides, I said to you the CapEx estimate in 2005 was 93 billion. So why have they raised 480 billion rand to pay for 93 billion rands worth of assets? That's over and above the price increases, over and above the conversion of debt of 83 billion which they used. They sold shares in telecoms or whatever to lend Eskom the money and then later on give it to them. The extent of the inefficiency is mind-boggling. It's absolutely, why would you spend 14 times more or raise 14 times more money than what you need to pay for the assets if they were, and that's at the inflated price. Why would you pay, if you buy a car, why would you pay 14 times more than the market value for the car? Because you'll never recover that money. So the Eskom asset base is standing at 743-odd billion rand. Nobody will give them more than 200 billion rand for those assets. So even if you had to privatize Eskom today, you will not get more than 200 billion. 200 billion doesn't even pay half of the debt. Never mind the excess tariffs that they've stolen out of our pockets. So it's really, I really don't think it takes a scientist or a genius to understand that we are facing a massive problem, an absolute massive problem, a problem that's big enough to collapse this economy.
Thank you very much, Honorable Luyenge. Honorable Mazon.
Thanks, Chairperson. And
the 10 minutes is still standing there.
Yeah, Chair, I understood that. I thought you'd forgotten it just now, but I certainly do know that. Chair, to Mr. Blum, you know, the scale of corruption that we're dealing with here, and the amounts of money are sometimes they're just hard to comprehend. Because, I mean, I say this all the time, we are desensitized from using the word million because we are so used to using the word billion. Now, when we try and unearth this corruption, obviously, I mean, you're in a fortunate position where your full-time job now is, you know, you look at how you're going to unearth corruption in ESCOM, and you focus specifically on that. But I'm quite interested in how you gather some of your information, because some of the information that you've got here today, certainly our prosecuting authorities, our SIUs, our committees, they should have that information and they don't. And that worries me tremendously, because that means that there is a deliberate effort by someone, and perhaps you could enlighten us as to who, is keeping that information secret. Now, Mr. Bloom, as I know you, you're a true patriot. And what I can't understand is, when you became aware of this massive amount of corruption, did you report it to someone who then refused to assist you in further investigations? Or did you just not know who to report it to when you were working, like that secret meeting that you went to at ESCOM, where I'm very proud that you turned around and said your mother told you not to speak to scum, if I remember your term correctly. Did you report that to anyone? Because, I mean, you said that you'd met with Jacob Zuma, the president, and I suppose, I mean, if you've met with him and he tells you a team is being put together, you assume that they're answering to the president. So was that perhaps, because at some point you just don't know where to turn next. Is that the position that you find yourself in? Because I know that your association with ALTA is relatively new. So I just want to understand, previous to your association with ALTA, who you tried to contact to alert. Look, it's a lot easier for us, because if we're alerted to corruption, we go straight down the road to the police station and we lay charges. And I mean, you know the amount of charges that we've laid in association with ESCOM and Trillion and Anoj Singh and. It's ludicrous, in actual fact, how many charges we've had to lay. But, Chair, it concerns me greatly. And I'd like some clarity from Mr. Blom. Did the ministers know, and you worked under Minister Hogan, Minister Gigaba, just Minister Hogan. Did she know what was coming? And is that why, I mean, you know, she's basically come out on record to say she was pushed out. Is, from your observations, is that what happened? Was she pushed out because she was asking too many difficult questions? Would Minister Gigaba have known about this? You know, we had Brian Dahmer sit here this morning. You know, at first he said he met the Guptas and he couldn't really confirm if it was one of the Guptas. You know, these things are very up in the air. I find it difficult to believe that things can be so up in the air. For me, things are very black and white. You either met with the Guptas or you didn't. I mean, I would never go to a meeting and sit and talk to people who I didn't know who I was talking to. Perhaps that's just me. But certainly, high-level officials must have known what was going on. You know, when you tell us the story now about the coal trucks going down the road, paying off an ESCOM official, turning around and joining the back of the queue. Now, I know in this committee, I've sat on this committee since 2011. One of the things this committee interrogated fully was, why was coal taking so long to get to the power station? And we were told there were these infinite lines of coal trucks waiting to go in. I mean, at that time, certainly that the officials coming to report to this committee knew that the coal trucks were arriving, paying off, and then going back to the back of the line. It is impossible, quite frankly, that anyone didn't know what was going on. That's my take on it. And I'd like to get your opinion on whether or not anyone can claim they just didn't know. Because I'm sure, like many South Africans and like me, you're also a bit sick of this I didn't know it was happening scenario and story.
Thank you very much, Honourable Member. Let's talk about the last issue first. When I did my initial reports and found out that Eskom was buying in all this coal from third-party contractors, which was different to the previous model prior to 2000, I wrote several reports on the deficiencies in Eskom's procurement on an ad hoc basis. At that stage, I wasn't aware that it was being done under the medium-term core mandate. I'd just been re-employed by Eskom, but I was aware that the practices certainly weren't regular. I then wrote in the report, and those reports, I believe, were forwarded to the head of generation, and the previous witness who was here was certainly made aware of that. I was requested by the head of finance, Mr. Unkababa, to keep myself available to be transferred to the coal procurement division directly so that I can have a greater access to what is going on there. In fact, that coal procurement department was overnight moved out of Megawatt Park into a rented building with special security access where I couldn't get access to it. So I believe you're right when you say that there were people in the know. The organized crime unit, of which there's a forensic report, which I haven't seen, but I heard that was paid for, involved, apparently, I'm told, 54 people. Well, that's organized crime. So was my immediate superior aware of it as a contractor? Yes, most certainly. And I've got copies of those emails which I've made available to the investigating officer, which obviously some of them needed a little bit of explanation, but those emails are there, including the double pricing issues, including the stock, pending blackout issues. There's written proof of all that stuff. In terms of meeting the fix-it team, well, I didn't know who to go to after that because I'm really already dealing at the senior level of the country. And somebody who had convinced me his mission was to clean up corruption. He went public with that. We can have a look at TV records. And post that, I also had a midnight visit to my house where people kept trying to get through my roof, unknown people. That was reported to the police. I've never heard anything further about that. My security watchman, who I had employed privately, was rummaged in that whole process in the middle of the night, and he left my employer shortly thereafter because he didn't think he was being paid enough for the risk. I've also, when I was invited to address an international speakers group involving investors and hedge fund managers, where it was shortly after I'd blown internally the corruption at Eskom, I received a letter of demand from the previous witness's legal advisor telling me to shut up and that I was not to speak and address this conference talking about the inadequacies within Eskom. That is written. I've got a written copy of that, and in fact Arta has got that on their computers as well. For my own safety, I've made copies of all this stuff available to Arta.
Thank you.
You see the kind of presentation. It's so scary. And at times you're not sure if you're listening. A normal presentation, you're not sleeping, it's a dream, that somebody has got the kind of facts that you're presenting. Where I'm sitting, Chair, I think we already inquire on the state of governance in Eskom. Surely the kind of presentation that I put across by Mr. Ted, they relate to a state of governance. But in a more narrow, focused, specific, factualized manner. As a result, I don't want to spend a lot of time with him as far as I'm concerned. I think the biggest challenge we have is with the bigger picture of Eskom inquiry that we're doing. We need a way forward with regard to a process that helps to verify, affirm. In the process of doing so, you know who, for example, let me give you an example. let me say, Mr. Bloom would demonstrate that I sent an email to Minister so-and-so at this particular date. You may want to know what did the minister do about that. I submitted to the police ABCD on this date. We may want to know what did the police do about that. Hawks and whoever else. In other words, I'm trying to say there are various ways that can emanate out of getting close to that information. So that there's a section that says to-do list or something like that. I think, in my view, that the committee needs to zoom in that to-do. We don't want to spend a lot of time with what looks as facts, because we might end up making a story out of facts. When facts are put before you, all what you need them subjected to some credible scrutiny. Because to be honest with you, if we've got such information in this country, and it has become normal to have an information of this kind and nothing is being done, actually it means even the exercise we're involved in is not worth going. So I'm saying, Chair, all I'm proposing is that our technical guys, let's find a way forward with this work and check, for the purpose of our period of investigation, where does it assist us, and as far as other institutions are concerned, what does the committee do to make sure that everything reaches a conclusive, what you call, a conclusive phase. I don't even want to stress Mr. Bloom to say he must respond. The thing that he's doing, if they are as truthful as presented, are scary. You're not supposed to sleep without reaching a conclusion when you've got information like that. Especially if it comes before yourself as government. I just wanted to say, that's my general comment.
Thank you very much. I don't think you need to respond to the comment, but just take into consideration what has been raised. Honorable Sage.
Just two quick issues. I think Honorable Mubele is right. Because over and above what we agreed upon earlier, was that at some stage, even those that are implicated will have to be given an opportunity to try and come up with their own side of the story, so that we are then able to chart the way forward in terms of how best can we deal with these issues. The two issues. One is your what we call the call pro comment mandate. Because from what you have been saying, in terms of that mandate, some of the things have to be handled without any normal tender process. So I'll appreciate if you can just briefly talk to that particular aspect. Maybe let's start with that one. I'll come to the other last two issues.
Thank you very much, Honourable Member. Okay, so that's why I had to start in 2001. The origin of the medium-term coal procurement emergency mandate was because Majuba Colliery was closed after weeks of production because there were technical problems with the coal field. And not only technical problems with the coal field, but there was also a problem with the mining plan. So Eskom had spent a lot of money investing into Majuba Colliery. They built Majuba Power Station for about 13 billion rand at the time. And when they came to producing coal, they couldn't produce coal at the right price and the right quantity. So immediately they closed that power station, that colliery in 2001, and immediately they had to find additional coal to keep the power station going. And that's when they devolved this emergency mandate thing to allow them to buy coal from all the other players. And that was supposed to last for 6 years. And that 6 years, Eskom should have had enough time to find either revisit that mine and change the mining method, which was possible, and that would be my recommendation today, to stop all this transporting of coal to Majuba and to reopen the mine but use conventional mining technology as opposed to longwall mining. So that's where it originated. After 6 years, Eskom still hadn't found a long-term supplier for Majuba. And the reason why was because of all the stealing and corruption. It wasn't worth their while to find a long-term, another Anglo or Billiton or Xstrata to mine this coal, because then there wouldn't be the opportunities in transport and all the other arbitrage.
Okay, Mr. Ted, I understand. So, in essence, what we are saying is that all these things were done according to the procurement mandate. Just that the difficulty was that it was not in accordance with the PFMA, but it was in accordance with the procurement mandate. I think let's leave it like that. The last one, it's on the crisis committee. You were part of the crisis committee. From what you're saying, you were later removed. Who was part of that committee, maybe? That would be the very last one.
Okay, so there were quite a number of people on that coal crisis committee. Some of them were present at Eskom's offices. We met at like 6 o'clock in the morning every day. Some of them were on the committee with the power station managers, and they were joined by teleconferencing. So it was quite a big committee. I think it was about probably 25, 30 people on that committee. And if my memory serves me correctly, that meeting was chaired by Kiran Maharaj. But I have minutes and I have emails from those which I can make available immediately after the session, so that you can have immediate access to the constituency of the coal crisis committee. I was told that I was there to withdraw because, given that I was an observer on behalf of the finance division of Eskom, and I was critical of some of what I said was the amateur methods being deployed in sourcing coal, given that it was a crisis. I can understand that from a political point of view, they don't want somebody from another department meddling in the coal procurement department.
Okay, now that's
Honorable Nopan. Thank you, Chairperson. I don't have much. Mr. Bloom, can you forward to the Chairperson's office the names of the fix-it team? I'm very interested in that. The people who constituted the fix-it team.
I believe that those people are identifiable. I wasn't at that meeting for long enough to actually get their names or business cards, but the channels are there for those people to be identified. There were 6 people, if my memory serves me correctly, and they were all eminent people. They were all their titles, doctor and professor and so on. And certainly I will speak to the chairperson and make it available immediately after this meeting.
Now, thanks, Chair. Can I get this clear in terms of the process? You said you met Mr. Jacob Zuma, and then what happened in that meeting? Yes.
Okay, so that's correct. We had a meeting for, I think it was a dinner meeting. We were supposed to meet at 5 o'clock in the afternoon. We were held in abeyance, and eventually we were told it's no longer a dinner meeting, but that we need to go to Mr. Zuma's house in Forest Town. We got there, and we found out that we were part of a queue of people waiting to see him. We signed the police register, because there were policemen guarding the house, and we eventually got to see Mr. Zuma between 10 and 11 o'clock in the evening after queuing for I don't know how many hours, like boaters in the road just about. And at that meeting, I handed over what I had perceived was irregularities on the coal account. It was a document, a presentation of about maybe 10 or 20 pages long. Mr. Zuma categorically said that he would have a look into this matter, and he took the document, and I still remember he put it on the sideboard inside the house. Mm-hmm. And I thought to myself when I left there, well, that's the last of that document, but obviously it wasn't.
And then what happened? When you say we, who were you with?
Okay, so I was with the person who coordinated that meeting and his son.
What is his name?
Mr. Norman Lowenthal.
Okay. The one of the JSE.
That's it.
And then after you met with him, he referred you to the fixer team.
No, I was informed a few weeks later that the fixer team were ready to meet with me, and I was invited to a meeting in Midrand, in the Bowdoin Shopping Center.
So the fixer team meeting was a result of the meeting with Mr. Jacob Zuma?
Yes, he said he would get his fixer team to meet me.
And instead of fighting corruption, the fixer team then said that they want to eat with you.
Say that again, sorry.
So instead of fighting corruption, the fixer team said they want to eat in Eskom.
They're not, yes, they want to eat Eskom, but they didn't want to eat me. They wanted me to, they wanted me to help them to eat.
You must help them to eat.
Yes, because I've got so much experience, and I would be able to maybe guide them to an easy meal.
And then you then said, no, I'm not part of that, and then left the meeting.
My departure was more violent than that.
No, that's fine. I think it will be helpful to get the names of the fixer team later on, so that we know the, to keep this trail of the people who are who come as a result of a presidential referral, and then instead of fighting corruption, they then say they want to eat, they want to loot at an industrial scale, because I think what is happening at Eskom is looting at an industrial scale, which we'll deal with at the end of this process. And then in the slide there that says that members of the Presidential Council sold uranium reserves at $2.5 billion to Arriva. What is the context of that, and who are the members of the Presidential Council?
The context of that is that, to put it bluntly, I think the same thing is happening with Shivers Uranium, where Arriva believed that they had a contract or would win a tender. The payoff, I believe, was $2.5 billion, on the basis that they would recover the $2.5 billion through the tender from with Eskom.
So who are those people of the Presidential Council? Do they have names and surnames?
Oh, certainly, there's a document, a document available on that.
You'll give us that. And the information that you're giving about NERSA, is it just speculative information or it's concrete information? Because I think that is the most important thing, where the looting in Eskom later on gets to be corroborated by NERSA, and people end up paying high costs for electricity because people are stealing Eskom and everything else. There. Is there concrete information around NERSA, which you can make follow-up on?
Up to about a month ago, I wouldn't have believed that that was that bad. I've got correspondence that's less than a month old that makes me very, very concerned about NERSA.
And the, can you just quickly to issues I wanted to take us through, is what you said is boosting balance sheet to raise more debt and the missing trillion. What is the context of that? Like just two aspects before I come to my last issue.
Okay, so when you deal with bankers, they always want collateral. You'll know that if you want to go and buy a house or take a loan, they always want collateral. So to the extent that you can revalue your assets and make them look as if they're gold when they're not gold, or valuable when they're not valuable, you can borrow against those inflated values. So realistically, I believe the market value of Eskom's assets is around about $200 billion maximum. To the extent that they are up at $700 billion, that's because Eskom borrows against those so-called assets, fictitious in this case. They got away with borrowing $480 billion, of which only $300 and something is guaranteed by the government. Those bankers that lent them the money look at the assets and said, wow, there's a lot of assets here, there's a lot of collateral, so we can give them more loans. Okay, so that's the one aspect. In terms of the trillion, I'm saying that more than a trillion rand in excess money has moved through Eskom's treasury in three components. The one is the excess tariff, above 30 cents a kilowatt hour. Okay, and that number I'm happy to prove. It's a benchmark independent number, which I've had checked. The second part is the borrowings going from 14 billion to 480 billion. Okay, so you add that up. And the third amount is the 60 and the 23 billion that government sold shares in Vodacom or one of the telecom companies, and then lent the money to Eskom, and then because Eskom can't pay it back, converted that into equity. So if you add those numbers up, you come to well over a trillion rand. In fact, if I'm given the benefit of the doubt, I mean, I could probably indicate at least 40% more than
that. I get the 29 billion, because I know that we passed a special appropriation bill that was asking for 29 billion, which would result as a disposal of Vodacom shares. and from and then that was sold to PIC, and then that money was then utilized to bail out Eskom. And what about the 60 billion? What is it about? Where does it come from?
It was a similar loan from the government to Eskom.
Oh, yes.
And that was, eventually Eskom couldn't pay that back either, and that was also converted to equity.
No, that's fine. I know maybe you don't come from a legal background and everything else, but what becomes the legal basis of your proposal that you must grant amnesty to people who are corrupt?
Okay, so that's probably the weakest part of my armor. And it's not something that I would contemplate in the normal course of events, but given that we're sitting with this shortage of evidence, and my belief that, and I've been tipped off that there is far more than I even have time to read through my inbox. The only way to fathom how deep and how wide this corruption is to sort of at least offer some sort of amnesty and get the people. Because people are incriminated, because you're going to ask those same people, why didn't you blow the whistle? You've been aware of something for more than 10 years. Because you didn't blow the whistle, you're incriminated as well. And if people feel that threat, they're not going to come forward and offer their testimony or their witness or their stories. And also, if they don't get amnesty and whistleblower protection, they stand getting fired. I mean, this previous witness this morning talked about Dr. Mark van der Riet. I know Mark van der Riet, and he is a super guy. And Mark has been on suspension for more than 3 years or 2 years because he wouldn't sign up on the Gupta calls. I mean, that's what happens. People get bullied. People get abused. So unless there's some sort of amnesty, and I really think this committee needs to apply its professional mind and maybe get professional legal input on that, but even if it's a proportional amnesty or some type of amnesty, because, yes, I can see that you and I feel the same, that we don't want to just allow people, crooks, just to walk away free. So maybe there's one does it in waves or something, but I'm sure that with the experience and the collective intellect of this committee, we can come up with some sort of program that might be suitable.
No, that's fine. Thanks, Chair. I'm done. I won't agree later on when we then sum up the discussions that we must grant amnesty to criminals who are stealing from state-owned companies. I think we must take decisive action because it will not be sustainable. I don't think also it will be legally sound to just let people go. It might take time. I think when the politics stabilize, we will reach them. The law, the hand of the law, the arm of the law is very long. It will reach all of them and we'll pin them down. They'll be held accountable, all of them.
Thank you very much. Honorable Kwang, you would be the last in my room.
Thank you, Chair. You know, the comment about NASA, I think, sent chills down my spine, because it means then there is a coalition, as I said to the professor that presented yesterday, of rent seekers and corrupt people who are living off the backs of the poor. Because we go around as politicians trying to campaign for the electricity price to come down, but they do the opposite. But I think your input helped us to a large extent, where you were saying what effect that has on the electricity price per kilowatt. I think we need to have more of those discussions, because then it's based on figures and facts and figures that and calculations that you've done. Maybe we need to get that from you as well, as the professor yesterday also promised to do the same thing. The Coal Crisis Committee, you say in your presentation here that the effort to try and address the challenge that faced Eskom at the time was amateurish at best. I think you said so. In what way was it amateurish in your view? Because my view is that, remember, Eskom still uses coal, and some of the key elements of what they need to do properly would be gained from people who have experience, like yourselves, in that industry in guiding such initiatives and going forward in future. That might also advise and guide us, for example, when we decide and recommend that around issues of coal as a committee and how it manages it. But there is a very important point that you also made earlier. You said they have breached the PFMA by buying coal on the open market when there are more cost ways of buying coal. What did you mean by that? What are those cost-effective ways, so that we're aware of them? and that we can also apply our minds to them as proposals. You also said that there were 400,000 tons of coal that were written off. Do you know what the financial value of that, and who benefited from that in the main from those write-offs? You also spoke about kickbacks from labor brokers. And is this fact or this speculation, suspicion, right? What sort of kickbacks, in what amounts, and who benefited? I suppose that some of the answers to the questions may be things that you'd have to do in writing as you assist this committee in its first fact-finding mission in trying to drill down to some of the problems that face ESCOM at the moment. But just a quick question right at the beginning. You said that pre-1994 ESCOM ran for about 100 years and never had to need a guarantee per se. Is it, from where I'm sitting politically, a neat comparison to compare what happened in the before 1994 at ESCOM, considering that, for example, it had to supply electricity to a small sector of the community as opposed to the demand that it had later on, for example, when it had to supply to everyone in South Africa, for instance. The other important issue which I want to ask you is that I think right at the beginning, when you were still giving your problem statement, you spoke about a number of procurement, preferential procurement legislations, which is centered around empowerment mainly. And because they're a problem statement, when you're saying those acts are a problem in their own, or you're saying the manner in how they are abused and hijacked was the problem on its own. And I didn't get, even though you included it in the problem statement per se, you just lumped it together with some of the problems at ESCOM without distinguishing between the two to say that our politicians were abusing acts that are intended, laws that are intended to transform the economy and transform society from an economic perspective for their own narrow acts. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Honourable Member. Can I just correct the member, if I may? My scenario was before 2000, not before 1994. And I'm not trying to score political points here, I don't believe. The governance of ESCOM changed in 2000 with the change of the legislation. So prior to that, there wasn't a board in charge of directing and governing ESCOM. It was an electricity council, which was made up from electricity users. So the large electricity users were guaranteed a seat on that council. And there's a good reason for that, because they're the ones who are paying for this electricity. And I don't believe any large company or consumer of electricity wants to pay more for electricity than he needs to. There were also representatives of the public on that committee. So instead of being a politically appointed board, as you see currently with ESCOM, that was a representative board under the Electricity Council. So I don't think it's got anything to do with race. It's probably got more to do with politics and the post-94 politics, where the board has been captured by the current regime for nefarious reasons. But certainly prior to 2000, the rationale behind appointing the Electricity Council was very clear. These are the people who are going to pay for this electricity. And if it was expensive, they would be the first to complain about it. So if I may just correct you about the dates and the constituency of that governance structure. Secondly, in terms of the BE issues, I think that unfortunately, as a lot of these other things involving BE, there's people that are just so greedy that under the guise of BE, they start milking the cow, and excessively milking the cow. And I think this is what happened at ESCOM, is that people under the guise of BEE and this new preferred procurement legislation manipulated those rules and regulations and started doing the nefarious joint ventures to screw the system. And at optimum, certainly, the price of coal was much lower because of the long-term contract than what the going rate was for lack of a better word, the black market. So what happened is because the BE guys were being offered a premium of up to 200% of what the going rate was, Optimum deliberately withheld coal from ESCOM and sent it on the same conveyor invoiced under BE at 200% higher money. And I don't think this committee has the checks and balances in place to firstly spot that and secondly to stop it from happening. If I then go to the labour brokers issues, that matter has been extensively reported by Peter Louis Myberg, one of the journalists, and the company, the one company that was involved there, but there's more, it was BIE Labour Brokers. They got into a dispute, and that matter certainly has been through the courts. But what hasn't been through the courts is the fact that there was quite a lot of kickbacks, and then all I'm saying is that at that time, kickbacks became the norm within Eskom. I'm aware of many more kickbacks other than that one instance, but that's when it became public. And I think that this committee needs to put a task force together to have a look at the culture of kickbacks. Maybe it was there before that, but certainly that was when it surfaced. And it's still there to this day, the kickback culture. And really, you can't operate with a kickback culture because it doesn't make for transparent pricing. In terms of the 400,000 tons of coal, that the ruling prices in those days, that was at least at least 40 million rands worth of loss, if not more. As we said, seven rugby fields, treetop height, 20 metres high or 10 metres high. It's not something that you're going to miss easily. But Eskom wrote it off. And that wasn't the only call that Eskom wrote it off. They have written, if we get Eskom to come and testify and ask them to show you year by year, there will be some rattles and they will be justified because some coal falls off the truck or falls off the thing or isn't usable or gets pulverized in manhandling and so on. But certainly not one shot of 400,000 tons at one power station. That's not acceptable. So I think that Eskom must be called to account to explain that. And that happened under the previous witnesses regime. Then in terms of, you asked me then in terms of the coal procurement mismanagement, the other amateur issues. Well, it was actually reported in the press, if you can just stretch your memory back far enough. This previous witness who sat in this chair early on today was boasting about paying 500 rand a ton for export coal, which he directed towards this coal shortage. Now, that was amateur, because you can't use export coal in Eskom power stations. The grate is far too hot, the boilers will melt. But that's the type of nonsense that was going on, is that, you know, you go and buy export coal because you're now saving the country. It's absolute nonsense. And then most of the salvage operations were put in the hands of one person. And given that Eskom is supposed to have a team of buyers, that wasn't a healthy situation. In fact, and I can mention it now, it's only my testimony, because as I said, there's thousands of other issues. But there was one particular coal buyer from Eskom who reportedly drove around in his bucky with 80,000 rand in brown envelopes behind his seat. I mean, this is the level of corruption that's going on. And I've got people who can, I mean, we can virtually phone them now and put them on the phone and they will corroborate that. Because they sold something to this person and he took out this envelope from his car and paid them in cash. So, yes, I mean, that was ongoing. Sorry, there was one more question? It was around the call?
Your question's all responded to.
No, he has. You combined the one about the effective ways of buying coal together with the amateurish issues in the committee that you picked up.
Yes.
You combined the two.
There's lots of that, yeah.
So your questions are answered?
My questions are answered. I just want to make one quick comment, Chairperson. No, my 10 minutes is not up. I'm still left with a minute, Chair. There's this issue. You lumped your pre-1994 story together with your 100-year history of Eskom. That is where
pre-2000.
No, I'm saying your pre-2000 history, you lumped it together when you're talking about the 100 years of Eskom not needing a guarantee and so on and so on. That's what clouded the
issue. That's a fact.
Yes. I'm saying that's what clouded the issues, even though it's a fact. But it clouded the issues a bit. All right. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Mr. Blom, I don't have any questions for you. Just want to remind you that you owe us some information that the members have asked for. So I just want to remind you that you don't forget. I hope you have recorded everything that they asked for. But anyway, I want to say thank you very much for for your indulgence, and thank you very much for availing yourself for the second time in this committee. We know you have a lot of work. This committee has taken this initiative to make South Africa know and understand why certain things are happening. So, but also to let people know who are outside there that if there is anything that they think they can help in reigniting the economy of South Africa, they can come and help us in reigniting the economy and come up with solutions, because we are in this together. We need to pull each other up out of where we are now to get out at a level where a level that is acceptable worldwide of these SOEs, especially those that are under public enterprises. I am speaking about them only because I have to look at them. And thank you very much, members. Thank you very much for sitting in the committee up to so long. There is lunch available, but it's because of the budget constraints. It is only meant for members of parliament. Yeah, we need to look at the budget constraints, because we have a former minister of finance who introduced those budget constraints. Thank you very much. Thank you to them, to the people that came to listen, and thank you to the media too.
Thank you very much. Thank you to Arthur as well. The documents should be in your email. It was just too voluminous to bring it along this morning. There's a 90-page document. There will be more documents. And I think the bottom line is that the price of electricity needs to fall by at least 40%. And that will reignite the economy.
Thank you very much, Mr. Plum. The meeting is adjourned. We'll meet on Friday at 9:30.